Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Riley, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to this panel of the Court of Appeals, July 10, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar today, three of which are on our oral calendar and three are scheduled for our non-oral conference. And we'll be deciding all of the matters, conferring about all of the matters today. The first case on our oral calendar this morning is in the matter of the civil commitment of Rodney John, is it Hedginger? Am I pronouncing that right?
Hedginger.
All right. Counsel, I'm sure you're familiar with our rules, but for the record, I'll just repeat them for you. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for a rebuttal. Those timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the podium, which the yellow light indicates your time is running short. You have 5 minutes or less, and by the time it hits red, you should have stopped. Please be mindful of that. And also regarding the podium, if you're not familiar with it, a couple of years ago, we have this new fancy one that you can elevate to your height. There's a button in the front, so at your convenience, you can feel free to raise or lower it. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep an audio recording of the proceedings. With that, counsel, whenever you're ready for the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ali Afsharjavan. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota, and I represent the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services in this matter, who is the appellant in this matter. This case is about the commitment appeal panel, or the judicial appeal panel, granting respondent Rodney Hedginger's transfer to Minnesota Sex Offender Program's Community Preparation Services. The commissioner asked the court to remand this case to the panel below for more sufficient, for more particular findings that would comport with the characteristics of a order that comports with this court's decision in In re Spicer. The findings were not particularized, and they are not sufficient to provide this court with a sufficient factual. The findings aren't sufficient to permit meaningful appellate review for this court.
Well, we do have, unlike in some other cases that you've cited, the opinion of at least one expert that supports the district court's conclusion. Does this case depend on how we apply the standard of review? In some cases, we refer to the standard of review as de novo. Other cases, we seem to be referring to de novo, but yet essentially applying what appears to be a clear error standard. If there's evidence supporting the decision, we defer to the panel. Does the standard of review matter in this case? And if so, what should that standard be?
If the court were to find that the findings were particularized and sufficient under Spicer, then the court could decide on the merits of this case to determine whether the transfer was correctly granted or not. But before that could happen, there would be a separate analysis to see whether the findings comported with Spicer's requirements, if they're particularized to permit meaningful appellate review.
So I want to turn your attention to paragraph 22. It's in the addendum, page 6. What's lacking in that paragraph for adequate appellate review? There's a credibility determination. Earlier in paragraph 20, the panel set forth the 5 criteria.
Well, Your Honor, those are findings, but those are just rote recitation for the most part of the transfer criteria. And Spicer outlines other findings. For example, findings aren't to simply restate what experts said and what they said. They're not true findings if they said this expert said this, this expert said that.
Well, except that earlier in the decision, and I'm having a hard time with names here this morning, so is it Pascucci?
Pascucci, Dr. Pascucci, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so Dr. Pascucci talked about the various, her testing and what she found, and it would appear that in paragraph 22, the panel summarizes it saying we found her credible and these are her findings based on her interview and her testing.
It did find Dr. Pascucci, the panel did find Dr. Pascucci to testify credibly. That's correct, Your Honor, but Spicer also requires that a fact finder not simply adopt the opinions of one expert in toto.
Well, they can if they find that expert credible.
That's correct, Your Honor. They can, but there was no explanation in this order by the panel about why Christopher Schiffer, who testified on behalf of clinical leadership, why his opinion was maybe less credible or not, or was somehow discounted by the panel.
Well, maybe because at paragraph 16, for instance, Schiffer acknowledged that the images, and there was quite a bit of talk about these photos that the petitioner had collected were not contraband. They were countertherapeutic, and that he also had not received a behavioral expectations report for his possession of the images. So it does seem that the panel acknowledged different things and hinted about maybe why they didn't find Schiffer's opinion the most persuasive one.
There may be some, implicitly, it may be that the court or the panel did give more weight to Dr. Pascucci's opinion because it did grant transfer.
Well, I think that, it's explicit.
Your Honor, it did grant transfer, but it didn't thoroughly explain why the opinions of Dr. Carr, who conducted a sexual violence risk assessment in this case, why her opinion was discounted.
Well, what's the case that you are relying upon that requires the district court to expressly explain why it is discounting experts if the district court, or in this case the panel, expressly indicates that a conflicting opinion is credible and reliable and persuasive?
Well, Your Honor, Emory Spicer does discuss how the court needs to offer some explanation about why the opinions of some experts are discounted. And for example, looking back to this paragraph 16, it does talk about how the images of these young women, it wasn't a BER, a violation of program rules, but it was countertherapeutic. And that's another requirement of Spicer, that the findings be tied to the conclusions of law in a meaningful way. In this case, totally absent from the findings were what Mr. Hegginger's diagnoses are, the fact that he's diagnosed with pedophilia, the risk factors and protective factors, the fact that he has a deviant sexual interest in children, the fact that he is a clinical psychopath, and the fact that clinical psychopathy coupled with sexual deviance is the most robust predictor of reoffense. Instead of discussing any of those things with regard to the images and why it might be countertherapeutic for Mr. Hegginger to have those or why that might matter, in a conclusory manner, the panel said that it wasn't a violation. It could be that the panel thought that following program rules is the most important thing and the only important thing, perhaps, in granting a transfer, and that it didn't matter that it was anti-therapeutic, but it didn't say that.
One of the things that's unusual about this case, at least in my experience in reviewing these cases, is found at paragraph 7, and that's where Dr. Pascucci is one of the few doctors whose expert opinion I've seen where she interviewed the petitioner and did a risk assessment of him in 2014 and found him in a remarkably different place now, which I think is one of the reasons she opined that he had made substantial progress and was ready for a new setting and maybe had bumped up against the limits of what he could do in his current setting.
It is true that Dr. Pascucci did do a risk assessment of Mr. Hegginger in 2014, and she did clearly express that he's progressed significantly since that time. But per the testimony of Dr. Carr and Mr. Schiffer, he is participating in treatment, but he's not doing the core things that he needs to do. He has a sexual deviant interest. He's not disclosing. He's not really dealing with those issues. But he is improved in treatment. And I would like to add that, you know, for example, Your Honor, paragraph 7 does discuss how Dr. Piscucci's evaluation was based on her 2.5-hour interview with the petitioner, review of applicable records. That same type of discussion is not listed when in paragraph 11 when it discusses Dr. Carr. Dr. Carr did do a 2-hour interview in October of 2018, leading up to the part 2 hearing that was held in December. Could it be that the panel found the testimony and the evidence and the opinion of Dr. Piscucci more credible because it said that she conducted an interview, and maybe it assumed that Dr. Carr did not? It didn't really explain why it decided
I'm still at a loss of why. How particular you think the district court needs to be in outlining exactly why it favored one expert over another? And in the context of my question, when you think about it, in the framing of Spicer, which you're relying upon quite heavily, but I'll read to you part of Spicer, which doesn't seem to be a problem in this case. The court pointed out, after reciting the expert's testimony, the district court stated that it found, quote, Dr. Ahlberg and Marston's opinions more credible and persuasive than Dr. Kenning's opinion. A district court can't satisfy its obligation to find facts with particularity by simply adopting in toto the opinions of a particular expert. The problem with such an approach is illustrated by the fact that the expert's opinions in this case are varied and sometimes inconsistent. For example, the opinion of Dr. Ahlberg was not identical to the opinion of Dr. Marston. Dr. Marston, in fact, opined in writing that Spicer is highly likely to reoffend, but he also testified that Spicer's likelihood of reoffending is less than more likely than not. So that in the court goes on to explain that what you've got is a recitation of facts where the court says this witness testified this way, that witness testified this way, and this witness, and lays out all of the testimony and then just says, I find these credible and those not credible, despite the fact that that creates an inconsistency, so that on appeal, there is no way to determine what aspects of the two are being relied upon when they're contradictory to each other. In that case, appellate review is really difficult. The same thing is true in, I think you cited our opinion, the unpublished opinion in, is it Kirchhoff, I think, where I believe I wrote the opinion in that case, where you had 100% of the experts saying no to the request and the panel saying yes, without explaining why it is it was not crediting any one of the experts or why it is that the experts were entirely being rejected. In that case, we couldn't review. This case seems different from Spicer and Kirchhoff in those regards. Am I correct or not correct?
With respect to Kirchhoff, the three experts in that case did go one way. That's correct, Your Honor. But with regard to Spicer,
and the panel went the other way.
Correct.
Without explaining why. Just
correct.
Okay.
Correct,
so that's,
Your Honor.
That differs, you would agree, from this case.
I would agree that Kirchhoff is different. It
All
doesn't.
Right, so talk about Spicer.
But Spicer, there were the three experts, and they did go different ways. And in that case, even, it was the district court in that case, did say that it found that the certain opinions of the experts were more credible than the others. In this case, we just have Dr. Piscucci testify credibly.
Not certain opinions. In that case, it was in total, these two experts are credible. And so that was what supposedly the district court was relying upon. But the problem was, if you read those experts' opinions, they cut different ways. They conflict with each other, and they're internally inconsistent. So in that case, you would need to have some clarification. But in this case, the panel identified one of the experts, referred to that expert's testimony as credible, and said that it was well supported by facts, and the panel also discussed some of those facts. And I'm I'm struggling with whether you're asking us just to reweigh the evidence.
No, Your Honor. The commissioner is asking for a remand for more particular findings to comport with Spicer's requirements. And to Your Honor's point, there is a limit on how detailed findings need to be. I think that's clear in Spicer, too. But there are those three separate criteria that are pretty much absent here. I mean, it really did say, the order below recites all the evidence, says this expert said this, this expert said that, this expert opined this, and at the end says Dr. Pascucci testified credibly without saying why she was credible, without giving any sort of indication of why the other two experts in this case weren't credible.
Because her opinion is well supported by the facts in this case, and then they go through the facts. But my question for you gets back to Judge Ross's initial question. And so we often are in a situation where we are just making sure that there wasn't clear error below. We're not reweighing the facts. And it's not what would this panel have done if we had been sitting as that appeal panel below. It's, is there sufficient evidence in the record to support it? Am I wrong in looking at it that way? And so if Mr. Bigelow were up here as the appellant, it might be us saying to him, but Mr. Bigelow, here are these other experts, and there is support.
Your Honor, I believe that Spicer is that threshold issue about whether or not the findings are sufficient for this court to review it. If the court determines that it is sufficient, then it goes to the review of the reviewing the panel's findings for clear error and then applying the law to those facts de novo. In this case, if the court believes that this set of findings is sufficient for review, the court should reverse because the panel clearly erred. None of the experts were discredited. We had two out of three experts testify that transfer is not appropriate. And I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And you will have that 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Bigelow. I'm attorney of record for Mr. Rodney John Hegginger. And it is his request to be transferred under Minnesota Statutes 253D.29 to a less restrictive environment, namely community preparation services. So rarely do I have the opportunity to argue and defend a three-judge panel order, and I'm happy to do that today. I'm not going to recite what I've stated in the brief. I think I've tried to respond to the commissioner's concerns.
Can you speak to the standard of review?
Pardon me?
Can you speak to the standard of review? We seem to have, I suppose if I were in your shoes, I would wonder what our standard is. We have some cases saying expressly de novo, but seeming to apply a clear error approach. Are you aware of any cases where we actually apply a de novo review standard in the way that term is generally understood, which is we're going to decide this case as if we are the original decision maker?
And I don't think that is the standard. I think there is great deference given to what is called now the commitment appeal panel in their judgment, in their judgment of credibility, what is relevant, what is material. And so I do believe that if we're talking about a standard, it probably is clear error on its face that you're looking for. And I would just argue today, if I can move beyond the burden, context. The context within which these cases are heard. Normally, we're scheduling half-day hearings for any request for reduction in custody. They're half-day. And so we have to line up witnesses and testimony, get ready to put that in within a half-day.
This seems to have been a bit more extensive in this case.
Yes, because more time was needed, because we spent so much time that first day with testimony from the client and also testimony from the court's examiner. But the point I'm trying to make is, in reduction in custody cases, if the client is denied, which happens many, many times, they wait 6 months and they can request again. If they're granted a reduction, if something goes wrong, the commissioner will pull that client back into the more restrictive environment, and we may have a hearing following that. So it's a bit fluid that way. That is unlike other cases where the court is actually asking us to submit proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, and orders. I can think of a couple of cases like that. Initial civil commitment cases, sexual psychopathic personalities or sexually dangerous persons. That's a given. We do submit. Why? And there are other cases such as termination of parental rights. Hundreds of proposed findings are submitted, conclusions and orders. Why? The finality of the final order. You're either committed or you're not. And if you're committed, it's indeterminate. And the knock is that they're not getting out, or not enough of them in due time. Termination of parental rights. That's the final order. You either have parental rights or you don't. If you don't, they're gone. You don't get a second bite at the apple. Okay? So given that context, in these cases, I'm suggesting there's an inherent flexibility as to what this panel can do, not beyond what case law provides.
Can I ask you, Mr. Bigelow,
yes.
do proposed findings get provided to the panel in a case like this?
Proposed findings, I suppose, I have not requested those. I have not been asked to give those, but we would submit those. I'm assuming the parties would submit those to the panel.
But from your experience generally, that's not the way it's...
Not unless there was one case was very... It was highly contested, and it was on a provisional discharge. The stakes were pretty high, and we had a week's-long trial.
Would
and
you
so
agree?
So it just seemed to make sense to
would
ask.
Would you agree here, as counsel for appellant points out, that, number one, there is no specific findings as to why the court found Dr. Pastucci credible, or at least by implication more credible than the other experts? There was no specific explanation of that difference that convinced the panel of her opinion versus those other opinions, and you believe, as counsel for appellant does, that's critical, an error that's critical pursuant to the Spicer case.
Well, my point being the flexibility in that the number and extent of the findings may be different in these sorts of cases. And we may have what we have here is an order we have to deal with, but I think the court, the panel, these are experienced judges who are making these decisions. They're utilizing an economy of words, if I might use that term. And although we don't have a lot of extensive findings, we do have, in the court order, we have the paragraphs that you've seen under the heading of findings of fact, but a lot of it is reciting the testimony that was given at the hearing and other exhibit information.
Yeah, isn't right? that part of the concern the Spicer court was getting at least, and other decisions that our court has reached too, is if a court simply recites facts versus makes specific credibility findings, that can be a basis for a remand because we can't review it.
And I think, is it Kirchhoff who says, one of the cases said we're not asking for extensive credibility findings as to why one expert is believed, why one is not believed. They're just saying we need a little something to review. Why did you find this person credible, right?
How much is enough?
Well, I would suggest that what's in this current order is enough.
How much is too little?
If there's no credibility finding at all.
So if there's a credibility finding without any explanation, just I believe this one, is that enough?
Well, I think, in context again, we have all of these findings in this recitation of the testimony, and I think it fairly describes the petitioner's, or at least now the respondent's position and requests, And then it fairly described the evidence opposing that. But I think, as the findings progressed, the court would always say, but in this case, or but, you know, on the other side of the coin, not using those terms, but I think that's how those findings were flowing. It gave fair view of both sides. And then on, I'm not saying unfortunately, but the controversial paragraph 22 within the order, it's like everything is coming together. The court's not restating what it's stated already, but it's kind of putting it all together and matching it with statutory criteria. So, again, within that paragraph 22, talks about the credibility, talks about the substantial progress of the client and the insight. Now, that's not just based on the expert. That's based on client testimony. That's based on other exhibits that were presented. Treatment needs. They recognize their remaining treatment needs. However, the best facility would be community preparation services. Why? The court says that continued progress in the current situation doesn't reduce the risk, the static risk. It's always going to be there. And I thought that was fairly described on the record.
It seemed to be some suggestion by Dr. Again, forgive me for...
Pascucci?
Pascucci. Suggesting even that keeping him in his current environment would be worse. And I don't think it was put in terms of creating a greater risk, but in terms of worse for the client.
There have been articles that have been written, and not a part of this record, I don't believe. But there's a thought that, and I think the Dr. Pascucci, the court's examiner, suggested that when a person reaches their maximum advancement in a program at a certain level, that it's best to move them on so they can further progress. If they don't have those opportunities to progress, that can be a negative sort of factor in their continued growth. So it's like they need
to move on. I understand. It sounded to me when I read the panel's analysis that was something that the panel took into consideration and was, at least according to Dr. Pascucci, a concern in this case for Mr. Hegginger.
And also on the one hand...
Am I correct about that?
Yes, yes. And also on the one hand, the panel recognizes that there still remains risk. It's not ignoring the risk that is measured for this client. However, unlike the other assessors, this particular court examiner is recognizing the protective factors, the gains, these coping skills that the client has achieved over time. So, which results in the need for less security. And any security that is needed, the court indicated that it could be provided by community preparation services. Plus, there was no evidence that this particular person would be any sort of a flight risk.
Can I ask you about that?
Yes.
I noticed that in that last, you define it as the controversial finding of fact 22. Although the panel heard testimony regarding petitioner's need for supervision, no evidence was presented that petitioner presents a flight risk. The wording strikes me as a bit odd. Is it not your client's obligation to show that he's not a flight risk as part of this request for transfer?
A part of the record, one of the questions was, have you ever, as an adult, left a treatment program? Because he testified about treatment prior to his civil commitment. He had treatment in the community. He had treatment in prison. And since that time, since he's been an adult, there was no evidence. He testified he's never absconded or left a treatment program in his history, all right? So which is significant? So the absence?
So your point being that was the affirmative evidence and the appellant did not respond in any rebuttal sense regarding that evidence, so hence that finding of no evidence of flight risk.
Which the court felt was significant. I think many of these hearings, the implication many times by the questioning from the commissioner is always, do they have access to other vulnerable people in the area? Or they talk about locked doors, unlocked doors, cameras, global positioning systems, you know, and the adequacy. And we're suggesting that's all adequate for the security given this client's history. And so if he's not leaving programs, he should be given credit for not leaving a program. And then finally, the court did talk about, as a result of these factors, there shouldn't be an unreasonable risk to the public if he were allowed, granted a reduction in custody to a more open program such as community preparation services. There is testimony in the records. This is not just an open door, backyard sort of program. They've got rules, they've got regulations, they've got security, and it's more secure on the front end as a person moves through that program. And he has treatment needs that community preparation services can meet and actually would be more therapeutic for him.
Is there, and Mr. Bigelow,
yes,
provisional nature to that transfer once that goes into place? In other words, if there is a violation on that, if the point you're making, one leaves, the GPS picks them up, they're not supposed to be there.
Well, there are restrictions, and if they try and resolve problematic behavior in a community environment, so it's more collaborative, communicative with other residents and other professionals. That's the tone of that program. And if that can't be accomplished, if that program cannot meet their needs, then there could be a basis to have them transferred back. So finally, if I might move on to the, since I have less than 30 seconds, I would just suggest we spent a long time over a two half-day period, presenting evidence on factors for transfer and also protective factors that in fact do reduce risk that were recognized by the court, but unfortunately was not recognized by the Minnesota Sex Offender Program or the original sexual violence risk assessor. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant, you have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Ali Afsharjavan, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Minnesota, on behalf of the Commissioner of Human Services, who's the appellant in this matter. Your Honor, if the court does find that, Your Honors, if the court does find that the findings were sufficient under Spicer and does wish to review this case on the merits, the Commissioner's position and the Commissioner requests that the court reverse the panel's order transferring Mr. Hegginger to CPS. The panel's order did not discredit the opinions of Dr. Carr or Mr. Schiffer.
So why do you say that? I mean, if you have conflicting opinions, if there are three people standing at the intersection and two testify the light was green and one testifies the light was red, and the court says, I'm crediting the testimony of the red light viewer. Does the court really need to expressly then say that the court is not crediting the conflicting testimony before we can infer what the court is doing?
Well, it's difficult to ascertain what portions of the testimony are being credited, if it's as to every factor, as if it's to everything that the person testified to. It's just a broad assertion here that Dr. Pascucci testified credibly.
But there's paragraph 22. There is sort of, she testified credibly and supported by facts, and here are those facts. So we see a listing of things that the district court seemed to rely upon. Is that enough?
It could also be, though, that it found the opinions of the other experts to be credible in part and maybe not in part. It doesn't say, but it didn't explicitly discredit them. In addition, Mr. Hagenger, the record does show that he is doing better in the past, but big picture, he has a sexual deviant attraction to children. It's a fixed attraction. He was civilly committed in 2009. He moved to phase two of treatment in 2013. And so he has been in treatment a long time, but there are still delays in disclosure. He downplays his sexual attraction to children. And for example, there is...
Well, there was some testimony that he downplayed it, but there's also some that he has a degree of transparency.
There is some, Your Honor. That's correct. But there was, in April of 2018, I believe it was, last spring, he did get a BER for having inappropriate movies. And then in June, after I believe it was in June of 2018, MSOB had discovered these images that he had of a binder of 200 images of women, some of them appearing to be underage. In treatment, he discussed, there's a treatment progress note where Mr. Hagenger was expressing to the treatment group that he didn't feel like he had to talk about it. And then he kept...
Those weren't treated as violations, as I understand.
That's correct, but they were considered to be anti-therapeutic by Dr. Carr and Mr. Schiffer. And then he did not destroy those images until after the Part 1 hearing in front of the Judicial Appeal Panel in August of 2018, and there's a progress note in the record saying that he was thinking about destroying them because it was discussed at his CAP hearing, or his Commitment Appeal Panel hearing. When asked about this, Dr. Pascucci kind of said this is a lapsed behavior, but he has a sexual deviant attraction to children, and this is counter-therapeutic behavior, as opined by Mr. Schiffer, Dr. Carr was concerned with this, and this spanned several months, and it was characterized as a lapse behavior.
Can I inquire, counsel, just to get back to Judge Ross's original, would you agree quantity of experts would not be the ultimate? In other words, that doesn't decide credibility for a judge. It doesn't need to be sufficient.
It could be, Your Honor, that there could be even more experts that go one way or the other, and the credibility, it's not quantity, Your Honor. It is about the credibility determination, what facts, what evidence a fact finder finds persuasive. And that is the problem with this case, that there's not a lot of explanation to the from the panel below about what parts and what evidence it found to be credible and what it didn't. There's this conclusory finding that Dr. Pascucci testified credibly. So, you know, the vast weight of the evidence in the record, if the court does review these findings, does show that the panel below clearly erred in granting transfer, Mr. Hagenger's transfer to CPS, and a de novo application of the law to the facts, to the vast weight of the evidence in this case, would suggest. And Your Honors may briefly finish.
I have a quick question for you. You can summarize in a sentence. Your time's up, but I'll let you summarize in one sentence. But first, let me ask you a question, since I think, Mr. Afshavan, that as far as experts go, given your role, you've probably had to read more of these cases than anybody in the room. So I'm curious about what your view is on the law. You've seen our cases that refer to de novo standard of review. Others have suggested a clear error standard of review. Despite what we label these standards as, what standard does it seem that we're effectively applying as you review the cases?
If the court is on the merits deciding the cases, a clear error for the facts that are found by the fact finder, and then de novo application of the law to the facts, Your Honor.
I think you're right about that. You had a summarizing sentence you wanted to give.
Yes, Your Honor. The commissioner would ask that the panel remand this case to the Judicial Appeal Panel for more particular findings. If the court wants to review this case on the merits and believes that the findings were sufficient, the commissioner asks that the court reverse the panel's order below. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Afshavan, Mr. Bigelow, thank you for your briefing in this case and for your argument. Very well done. We appreciate your thoughtful and insightful views about the law and the facts, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted. Thank you.